Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. I want you to remember me.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. RuPaul Charles has the Emmys, the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, a hit television show, of course. But most of all, America's grande dame of drag has legions of fans who live for the affirmation and entertainment, the realness and inspiration they take from his life as a black man, a gay man, and the world's most famous drag queen. For example, there's this recent moment from the show, RuPaul's Drag Race.
Let me tell you something. I have been discriminated against by white people for being black, by black people for being gay, by gay people for being too femme. Did I let that stop me from getting to this chair?
In a new book, RuPaul writes, "I am living witness to the revelation that once you get rid of all the negativity in your world, everything and everyone that might be blocking you, you will live in the light." But we spoke with RuPaul a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about his new book titled Guru. RuPaul, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. Wow, that's a lot to live up to.
Well, you're living up to it. It's your own record.
It is. You know what's funny is I do what's in front of me. I do what I think is fun and what's exciting. I love creativity. So, you know, if you're in the business for as long as I have, yeah, I guess you're going to rack up a lot of credits.
Good. Well, I'm glad you have. Now, listen, full disclosure, I'm a huge fan of the show. Everyone who knows me knows that. So I just wanted listeners to know that is the truth. For anyone who's seen RuPaul's Drag Race or followed your career, I mean, the show itself is so full of wonderful advice, vignettes from your own life. You talk about your own experience a lot as a gay man and a drag queen in America. So why did you think you wanted to write this new book? It's got a lot of life advice and craft advice in it, too.
Well, especially now, I think young people really do need a touchstone that could help navigate their journey. Our show really serves as that also with the stories of the queens who apply for this competition reality show. They come from varied backgrounds, but they all have the struggle in common. You know, they were ostracized by their family or society and had to make a way, had to sort of find the light to shine like a lotus in the mud. And in doing so, they are teaching young people how to not only find their tribe, but to find their light and to shine in that light.
Mm. And so in the book then, I mean, is it sort of a take it with you guide to find that light, as you say?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we in Orwell's Animal Farm, it's really a parable for humans who just, quite frankly, just forget. They forget what the mission statement was. And of course, in Orwell's Animal Farm, it's really about, you know, a revolution. But people have forgotten what it means to be American, what our mission statement was, which was openness and friendliness and forward thinking. We lost track. And I thought, you know, this book is really geared toward young people or anyone who just needs a reminder. It's a carry with you reminder of who you are and what your objective really, really is.
Yeah. I mean, and you use stories from your own life to do those reminders, right? I'm looking at, you know, a page here right early in the book where you talk about after your parents divorced, you and your sisters, you know, would wait for your father on your front porch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't show up.
Wouldn't show up. And you know, through years of therapy, all roads lead to that one moment. And I created an identity around that hurt. You know, looking back, it actually is something that I had to work through and that has made me stronger. And I have a lot of my personality packed into that one event in my life. And it's a constant source of hurt, but also of renewal and of really having the perspective now to see that it was his loss more than anything, because he could not see the beauty that was there and the love that was there. And I also feel sorry for my father, who's no longer with us, but that he couldn't afford to experience that because of his own hurt and his own pain.
But when you said that you have a lot of your personality packed into that one moment, I mean, tell me more. What do you mean by that?
The first half of my career was really about getting my father's attention. And actually, years ago, the psychic told me that he and I had shared past lives together. And so which really explained why I was so dead set on reminding him of who he is. And, I felt like, hey, buddy, oh, my goodness, here you are. This year we are going to rule the school. And he couldn't see me. And I was like, okay, yeah, oh, I see. You just need some of my joy, some of my excitement, some of my love, some of this to remind you of who you are. It just never really happened. And so years and years of going through that and therapy, I understood that he couldn't possibly acknowledge that, because he'd have to deconstruct all of his pain and walk through that. Not a lot of people can do that. That's why I think our show Drag Race is so captivating, because we get to watch these courageous kids that society has thrown away find a way to shine in the light. And we want to know that story. Each of us can relate to that. You know, how do you stay on path? How do you stay on track?
Yeah. I mean, you say that time and time again, these are your words from the book, you've recreated that victimhood in your life, in love, with all kinds of storylines that made you feel the way that being abandoned by your father did.
Yeah.
Is that your way of saying that recreating that victimhood is sort of part of the process that you had to go through, or that maybe that you didn't want to have to go through?
No, I recreated it until I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Uh-huh. I recreated the same scene. It's like, okay, here it is again. What's my lesson here in this? And I recreated it in relationships, in my relationship to society. Being a black person in this country, we're always very sensitive about, oh my goodness, is this going to be another put down situation? Am I going to be rejected in this situation? And I had to work through that, and I couldn't carry that hurt with me anymore until I did the work. And the work involved taking two steps back, figuratively speaking, and looking at the whole scenario. And in regard to my father was a damaged person. He was damaged by society, black rage. And so to key into my frequency of love and saying, I love you so much, would force him to get in touch with his own feelings, mm-hmm. which he couldn't. It was too dangerous for him to do it. So I thought, it's my job to walk through that pain and see what's on the other side, see what's on the other side of that. And that's what perspective allows you to do.
Yeah.
So here I am on the other side of it, and I can recognize when I'm walking myself back to that porch, so to speak, and say, no, that hurt wasn't on you. And I'm sorry, Rue, that happened to you, but that wasn't on you. That was on him. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with you. And do not let your ego co-opt that situation to put yourself down. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I think about those beautiful children on that porch, my sister and myself waiting, we'd say, next car is going to be daddy. Next car is going to be daddy. We were on that porch all day long. And that happened many times. It wasn't just one occurrence. It happened many, many times. When I look back on that with perspective, I see that it wasn't my fault. And it's important for me to push past that and create an identity that doesn't involve me being a victim.
Well, so can I ask you about that? Because so many people in the LGBT community look to you as a mentor. And these are also people who have very much been victimized, right, by society for the factor of their sexuality. So when you know, they hear you say that you push through to the point where you no longer saw yourself as a victim, I mean, what's your advice to them on that same process?
Well, I say this to everyone. First of all, life is not easy. Life is difficult. So let's just put that out there right now. I don't care who you are. Life is difficult. Is it more difficult for black people or gays or trans people? I don't know. I know from my experience. How you push through it, you have a choice in how you see any situation. And I was really sick and tired of recreating that same hurt. In fact, if you create an identity around being victimized, my ego will continue to look for situations to strengthen that identity so that I know where I stand. So in my life, I kept recreating the little boy left behind on the porch. I just kept recreating it until I said, no, the problem isn't what the world is doing to me. The problem is that I'm actually attracted to those situations. In fact, it sounds weird, and the ego's not going to like me saying this out loud, but I had fetishized the idea of being left behind. In fact, I seeked out situations that reconfirmed the identity I created. Let the church say amen.
Absolutely. Well, we are speaking with—
I think I need to say that again so people can hear it.
Say it again.
I kept recreating that same situation of me on that porch, whether it be in the grocery store where someone jumped in line at me. I said, oh, there it is again, to strengthen this identity I created of myself. So the key was for me to create a different identity, and the key was for me to not want the payoff I got from strengthening that old identity as the little boy left behind on the porch, to create a different, and actually several different identities, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. It does, actually.
Yeah.
And I want to pick up that thought when we come back, but we have to take a really quick break here. We are speaking with RuPaul Charles. RuPaul's new book is called Guru. And of course, we'll talk about the book more when we come back. We'll also talk about Drag Race as well. So just hang tight here for just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking today with RuPaul Charles. RuPaul is, of course, the force behind the Emmy Award-winning show RuPaul's Drag Race, which recently finished its 10th season on VH1. RuPaul's also author of the new book. It's called Guru, and that's what we've been talking about here so far. And RuPaul, you took us to a really interesting place just before the break here, but I also am a little concerned that maybe like this interview is getting a little too NPR-y, so I want to leaven it a little bit with a moment from RuPaul's Drag Race. So here it is.
Miss Banji. Miss Banji. Miss Banji.
that is Miss Vanjie making her exit from season 10 in one of the 10,000 memeable moments that come out of RuPaul's Drag Race. How much fun is it to make that show?
Oh, my goodness. It is so fun. You know, we produce the heck out of this show. We put everything together. Then we add drag queens to the mix. And then the hilarity ensues. But not only the hilarity, but the heart and the courage. It's so amazing. And the stories that they tell, it turns what we've produced into something of legend and of mythology and magic.
Yeah. So about those stories, I mean, over the course of the 10 seasons of Drag Race, and for folks who don't know, actually, I should let you explain for folks who don't know what the show is. I mean, but how would you describe what Drag Race is?
Well, it's a competition reality show where we are looking for America's Next Drag Superstar. And we put the competitors through a series of challenges that are not unlike what my career has been. I've done everything, you name it, in show business. So the challenges are geared towards, you know, being a radio host or a television producer or a model or acting, all of those things. And at the end, the two competitors who are at the bottom, who get the least points, have to lip sync for their lives.
Yes.
And they lip sync, and whoever does the best gets to stay. And the one who doesn't has to leave the competition.
And you always remind them to don't bleep it up. Okay, that's as close as I'm going to get to it on NPR here.
Yes.
But I mean, it is the show combines obviously just the visual spectacularity, I'm making up words now, of the drag queens, the challenges that you just talked about, the fun and the incredible hard work. I'm surprised that more of the queens just don't have a nervous breakdown on every episode. But with each passing season, we've also seen a lot more of their personal stories as well. And I just wanted to play a little bit of a montage of three moments where we learned some very incredible things about some of these drag queens. So here are those moments.
They got me exercised because they thought I was possessed by a gay demon.
I was so confused after the whole thing went down because was I straight now? Like,
I just wanted to say it. I've been always so afraid to say it. That I've been living with HIV for the last 2 years of my life, and this means so much to me. And you're gonna be able to embrace them. You're gonna find a group of friends who's gonna love you. You're not going to feel lonely anymore. And what you thought was all just a dream will come true for you, because life will get better.
Lovely. Kimchi, you didn't just get better. You got fierce.
Well, the three drag queens you heard there were Dusty Ray Bottoms talking about having to undergo gay conversion therapy, Angina on the very first season of Drag Race revealing that she was HIV positive, and the last one there, Kimchi talking to her younger self about the challenges that she faced. And RuPaul, if I remember correctly, Kimchi's parents didn't even know that she was on the show, that she was a drag queen, or even that she's gay, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. You know, the show challenges the contestants to figuratively die and become reborn into their higher self. And when I look back on my own life, I realize that the worst things that happened to me ended up being the best things that happened to me, because I got to understand what real strength is and what my own strength is. And I think the people watching our show, they get that, and they understand that at the core of our show, it's about the tenacity of the human spirit and how you are an extension of the power that created the whole universe. You can access that power at any time. But what, you know, when you're pressed in those horrible situations that these kids named, when you're pressed, that's when that power comes out. So if anybody out there is listening to us right now, understand that what you're going through is part of your metamorphosis. And sometimes, you know, I say this even on our country right now, which seems so divided and so ugly, but I have to believe that out of this metamorphosis, just like a butterfly, this violent metamorphosis, beauty will emerge. And that's what we watch on our show every season after season. We see these kids who have gone through a lot, mm-hmm. and they emerge as great beauties and heroes.
You know, and the thing about the show is that there's that intimacy and the challenges. But RuPaul, as you said earlier, there's also fun, drag queen drama and just straight up laughs. And I really think we should give everyone a sense about how entertaining the show is. So I want to play a clip. This is from season 6 and a regular feature where the queens dress as their favorite characters for RuPaul's spoof version of the comedy game show Match Game.
Now, are you ready to meet our stars?
Yes.
Good. Order in the courtroom, hunty. It's Judge Judy. Hey, Your Honor.
Did you forget you were coming to court today dressed like that? You look like a damn roll of scotch tape.
Well, I thought it was...
You don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Up next, Playboy Playmate and reality TV pioneer, Anna Nicole Smith is here.
Rock my body.
Yeah.
Want some money? Want a viper?
I gotta say, death really becomes her.
That's a scene from RuPaul's Drag Race. You heard drag queen Bianca Del Rio doing her Judge Judy impression and Adore Delano as Anna Nicole Smith in the show's version of The Match Game. Okay, look, we've been talking a lot about Drag Race, the show, RuPaul, which is just one of the most recent things that you've been doing in your really long career. And we've got a question that's come over Facebook for you. People really want to know more about your early years in drag. So Rob McCausland says, please ask Ru about his start in public access television in Atlanta.
Well, I had been working for my brother-in-law for many years in his car business. He used to flip European cars and also American cars, but expensive cars. And I'd done, you know, drama school and performing arts school and all that. But I was sort of hovering. And when I was about 20, I saw a television show in Atlanta on public access. So I wrote into the show and asked if I could be on. And what attracted me to the show was they felt like it was my tribe. It was the tribe I had been looking for. In fact, it was the tribe that I had knew existed because of watching public access, from watching public television, watching the Monty Python's Flying Circus. When I was about 10 years old, I knew that's my tribe. So years later, I saw public access in Atlanta, and a man named Dick Richards, who answered my letter and said, come on, be on the show. And it was off to the races from then, because they were my tribe. And Dick Richards put out my first records on his label, and he was a mentor to me that really kicked off my career, and I wouldn't be here without him.
Yeah. So specifically, when you first started doing drag, I mean, what was it that drag gave to you that you didn't have before?
Well, first of all, I've always said, you know, you're born naked and the rest is drag. Mm-hmm. Everyone on this planet is doing drag. So, and then as a kid, I decided I wasn't gonna not play with certain crayons. I wasn't gonna play with certain crayons and then not play with other ones. I was gonna leave that open. And that's because I grew up Monty Python, David Bowie. I'm an artist at heart. And so I wasn't going to constrict myself that way. So then I was in a band from the kids from the public access show. It was a bunch of people. We got dressed up in drag once, and just as sort of a political statement. It's the Reagan 80s, and, you know, it's a big FU to society. Well, the reaction I got was one I didn't expect. People were in awe of how I looked, even though I was doing this trashy punk rock style of drag. So I thought, note to self, this could be useful later. But I continued on with my rock and roll and punk rock, all that stuff. But my drag has had many different transformations. Initially, it was the gender F word style. Mm-hmm. Then it was my Soul Train dancer style, which was, you know, hotsy-totsy, sort of like a streetwalker. And then when I hit the big time, I changed it to Glamazon, which is what I still do today.
You still look so stunning. Oh, my God. I mean, I shouldn't even say still. You look stunning. In the book, in your book, Guru, you write that to get ready for the show, it takes you 6 hours?
It doesn't. You know, I will take 6 hours. I could do it in 2.5 hours. I could probably do it in an hour and a half.
But why rush?
But I like to take my time, and I'm also a producer on the show, so I'm taking meetings, and we're kicking, and we're in those 6 hours, we're gossiping, we're going over dialogue. It's a lot of stuff happens in that 6 hours. But, you know, it's interesting. People have asked me that from the beginning of my career. How long does it take? And I've surmised that the reason people ask is because the ego wants to believe that to shapeshift, it is a huge, huge process, but it is not. The ego wants to believe that the identity you have taken on is unchangeable and that it's solid and that to change, it's this huge production. It's actually not. It's a decision you can make at any time in your life. I call my drag the Superman to my Clark Kent or the Wonder Woman to my Diana Prince. In both those cases, you see that their transformation happens almost immediately, within seconds, and that transformation isn't just physical; it is a change of how you see yourself.
Yeah. Well, we have a little more of tape here from RuPaul's Drag Race. This is from season 9, and I think it kind of fits really well with what we're talking about now in terms of what drag has given you and how it transforms you, because this is a moment from a regular feature in the show where you go from table to table in the workroom where the queens are preparing for the challenges that you've given them. And you sort of talk to them, give them pointers, tips, advice, that kind of thing. So here's one of those moments.
Well, like I've always said, you know, drag actually reveals who you are. I knew I was powerful in drag. It didn't occur to me that I could utilize that in other areas of my life.
So you're telling me that I'm co-hosting next season? Michelle Visage, we don't need you.
Oh, no.
A little shot there, Michelle Visage, who's a regular on RuPaul's Drag Race. But RuPaul, I wanted to play that because of the fact that you said that drag gave you power in other areas of your life, too.
Yeah, my therapist said, you know, the power that you feel in drag or my Superman or Wonder Woman, you know, you can access that at any time. I tell you, it had never occurred to me. Because, you know, you put the outfit on and immediately people see you differently, they treat you differently. But I have that same power out of drag, which is monumental. It's huge, that concept. And so that's why that's such an important piece of tape right there. And I want the kids in the show, the contestants, I want them to understand that. That is huge. And for anyone listening, you can access that power at any time. You are an extension of the power that created the whole universe. Most people have forgotten that conveniently. They've conveniently forgotten that. Stop playing small. Play your greatness. Do your greatness. I think most people don't play their greatness because it takes a lot of responsibility. You have to be mindful, and you have to take care of yourself.
Yeah, but you know, like believing in your greatness, that can be scary. I think that's one of the things that the contestants confront so often. Like every queen, I think in every season, has talked about being in her own head too much.
Yes, and that's true for all of us. It takes time and it takes practice, you know. But I grew up in San Diego and. I had to play small so that I didn't attract too much attention or too much ridicule. It takes a lot of power to fend off a lot of that ridicule because other people feel threatened. Even the story with my father and leaving us on the front porch, I think that had more to do with him not being able to accept the amount of love these kids had for him. You know, it was too much love. So he'd rather go and drink or go play the horses. And I have to ask myself that same question. Where am I playing small? You know, I'm about to do this new series on Netflix called AJ and the Queen. Mm-hmm. And I'm acting in drag and out of drag in it. But it's terrifying me because I have to act on camera in a way I've never have before, where I'm playing a human being with human feelings. And a lot of my defenses are going to be down to portray this character. And that's what's so scary about it. But you know what? I've conjured this thing up, and I say, bring it on. I haven't come this far to, you know, wimp out and not play my greatness. And my greatness being, in this case, being my vulnerability.
Yeah. One more question about your drag in particular, because in the book, Guru, you write that your drag has been less about looking like a woman than about pushing back against certain conceptions of masculinity. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Drag is punk rock. Drag says to the identity, hoo-hoo, now I'm a sailor. Oh, now I'm a glamorous, synthetic creature of feminine proportions, you know. But my drag, I've never dressed like a woman. I only dress in drag. And there are people, men who dress in drag, like Elvis and Prince and Michael Jackson, where they've David Bowie and James Brown, where they taken a persona and just and heightened it. And of course, there are female drag queens like Dolly Parton, LaToya Jackson, and Cher, and Diana Ross, you know, where they take a concept and they turn the dial up to 100 on it. That's what drag is. But drag is also executive realness. I mean, people who work in an office or at a fast food place, they put on an outfit and go and present themselves. But, you know, my thing has been, why not do it all the time? Why not? I don't even dress up on Halloween. I think that's amateur night. I dress up every day except Halloween.
Well, we're talking with RuPaul Charles. RuPaul's new book is called Guru, and we've got a lot more when we come back from the break. So hang in there for just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. She's gonna work that sexy body so sexual. She's like a female phenomenon. She's a glamazon, female phenomenon. Glamazon, nobody do.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with RuPaul Charles. RuPaul is host and producer of the Emmy Award-winning RuPaul's Drag Race, of course, which completed its 10th season just recently on VH1. RuPaul has a new book out as well. It's called Guru. And if that weren't enough already, in March of 2018, RuPaul became the first drag queen ever to be honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And Jane Fonda presented him with the honor.
I'm really honored to be here. I look down and I see the star that's going to go into this Walk of Fame, but I think it should be at least three sizes bigger than any other star on the Walk of Fame, because I don't think anyone else on the Walk of Fame has ever launched an industry like RuPaul has. Behind the glamour, behind the drag queen, is a man of great depth, incredible intelligence, compassion. One member of our crew said that RuPaul is so zen that he felt his blood pressure drop when he was around him.
That's Jane Fonda presenting RuPaul with his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in March of 2018. Now, RuPaul, Jane Fonda also writes the introduction for your new book, Guru. So what's the connection to her?
Well, you know, I'm actually choked up hearing that, her say those things. So lovely. You know, I've always admired her. In fact, when she showed up on the cover of Life magazine in March of 1968 at our house, I remember emulating the pose on the cover of that Life magazine. She's on the cover as Barbarella. And it was a pivotal point for me because I thought so much beauty, so much strength. And then I tell you, 50 years to probably to the day, she gave me the star. She presented me with the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. But I've always admired her just because of how many lives that woman has been able to fit into one lifetime. And that, coming to this planet, I always felt like the boy who fell to Earth. That was always my goal. And that's why drag or shape-shifting or wearing all these different hats in show business has always been my goal, and I've always looked up to her for that. But before that, I guested on her show, Grace and Frankie, with Lily Tomlin, and it was absolutely beautiful. And that's coming up on the next season of Grace and Frankie.
Yeah. Well, you know, we told folks over social media that we were going to be talking to you today, and we got so many questions from them that I don't want to give them short shrift. Do you mind if I ask you some of the questions that we got sent to us here?
I don't mind if you don't mind me saying I don't want to answer that. Because, you know, listen, you know, people have a lot of ideas, and that's cute. But, you know, we'll see.
Okay.
Let's see what you got.
Okay. How about this? How about this is a pretty easy one. How about this one? Dan Church wants to know that he'd be interested to know if the change in the audience for Drag Race with more teens and young people watching has influenced how you conceive and produce the show.
No, it hasn't. You know, our goal has always been to celebrate the art of drag and the art of the people behind drag and tell their stories, because it's a very unique person and personality who's able to change themselves and to die, voluntarily die and become reborn into another incredible image of their own imagination. There's something very, very important there. So, no, what happens is we produce the show and then we add the queens who are different every mm-hmm. year, every season, and it takes on a life of its own.
So we've got a couple of questions here from folks who want to know how the mainstreaming of drag, and in part driven by the success of the show, may have changed the community itself. That's Cassandra Sunt. She wants to know that. And someone calling themselves Django James wants to know, what's the best way to tackle the racial bias issues that have become more apparent in Drag Race fandom as the show becomes mainstream?
Well, those are two big questions.
Yeah.
The first one is, drag will never be mainstream. Drag will never be mainstream because in our ego-driven culture, the idea of shape-shifting, which is what drag is, will never take hold, because the ego will not accept the idea of someone changing their identity. Our whole culture is based on identity. A consumer culture is there to sell beer and shampoo, and they want to pinpoint who you are, what your buying habits are, and what your belief system is. And drag is the opposite of that. Drag says, "Whoo, now I'm this, and oh, now I'm that." So drag will never be mainstream. You know, racial issues. It's within the drag community. What happens is, we get a lot of young people who have ideas of their own, right? And they walk into our show as a viewer with different ideas. I believe the racial divide with our viewers has to do with the fact that a lot of young people, they gravitate to what they know. So a lot of the girls who are blonde and white on our show will have way more social media followers than someone who is not blonde and mm-hmm. white. So that speaks to us as a culture, as Americans, as a people on this earth. It has very little to do with our show, because our show, I believe, we cast our show is the most diverse cast in television. We cast everybody. In fact, I think this past season, without giving anything away, I shouldn't say that because I was going to say who we have on the show. It's not a lot of white people. I'll just say that much.
You have your token white folks with
We have some. Have some. But listen, you know, we cast the show based on – the criteria is one – it's charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent. That's how we cast the show. If you got it, you're on.
And they do. Okay. So I just – I've been resisting asking you this question, but I just have to know because I'm a huge Shangela fan, and Shangela and all her fans are still wounded from the fact that you dropped her from the show in that great lip sync between her and Trixie Mattel, and I just still feel like she was robbed. What happened there?
Well, we first of all, you needn't feel robbed because Shangela is almost steals the movie A Star Is Born. She's in that movie and she does a great job in that. But the truth is, none of the girls are losers. If you're on the show, you're a winner. Even as you played the clip of Miss Vanjie, she did one episode and became an international star. So, you know, nobody loses. If you're on the show, you're a winner.
Okay. So that actually leads me to something else that I wanted to ask you about, because there's been a lot of media coverage of RuPaul's Drag Race because it has become so popular and it has really elevated the careers, you know, of the drag queens who appear on the show to superstardom level, as you said. But I think it was in a big New York Times article a while ago that talked, you know, is there a rift in the drag community a little bit between the queens who get to be on your show versus the many, many, many who don't? Because, you know, I've been reading that, you know, when booking shows now, folks are looking for RuPaul girls, essentially, who've been on the show and perhaps not booking very hardworking drag queens who just haven't been on television.
Yeah, well, that is the nature of show business. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I've been in fashion. I've been out fashion. I'm in now. I'll be out again. That's the nature of the business. And you have to keep your brand alive. And whether you're on TV or not, you have to make – listen, that's the law of nature. You know, if you are if you have some value to the jungle will support you. It's not personal. It's showbiz. It's not personal. It's drag.
So in the book, Guru, I mean, we've talked a lot about sort of the life advice that you give and the reflections from your own life as well. But as I mentioned earlier, you also talk a lot about the craft of drag. And, you know, I was wondering if there's some parts of that we could go through. I mean, there's, for example, you say that when all else fails, use a three-quarter view or three-quarter pose when being photographed.
Well, it's just an angle of your face that is the most complimentary.
Okay.
It's practical things like that. You know, it's always interesting to me that these life hacks, people forget. I mentioned Animal Farm earlier. People simply forget how life is done. And young people need mentors, like Dick Richards was a mentor to me, as you know, in my early career, to help guide them. And that's what I intended Guru to be, the book. It's a way to just have a view of life that is like a GPS system.
Yeah. And you say know your proportions, meaning what?
Well, the way the human eye sees information and interprets information is your key here. So, say for instance, with me, I have very long legs, and my torso is shorter than my legs are. So, I like to keep my neck area unobstructed. I rarely wear a necklace or something that's going to cut off my neck. I always like to keep that open, and that's just a small trick. But that's true. In life, the way humans interpret – the human eye interprets visuals is the way you should proportionize yourself.
Hmm. And so what are some other pointers that you think people ought to take away here? Because there are so many, actually.
There are so many. But the main ones, even if you're not in drag, have to do with your perspective, your perception and your perspective. You know, when a plane takes off into the horizon from where you're standing, it looks like the plane is getting smaller and smaller, but it is actually not getting smaller. It's just your view of it. And the truth is, it's important for humans to remember to look beyond their own vision of themselves, to see yourself the way, say, for lack of a better word, the way God sees you. And God sees you as the most beautiful thing on this planet. You are a gift to this earth. Do not forget that. And it's very easy to forget it because we read magazines and see television or television commercials that say, you're not really clean unless you're zestfully clean. For us people over 50, remember that commercial. You know, the truth is, you're perfection. And don't forget that.
Hmm. I'm curious. Are you with the show, especially, and the fact that you have been mentoring so many drag queens for several years, drag has become, I mean, okay, I heard you earlier saying it's never going to be mainstream, but it's become sort of more widely known. And you by far are, I think it's safe to say you're still the most popularly known drag queen pretty much anywhere. I was going to say, how long can that last? That's not really the right question. But I guess I'm wondering, do you hope for a time when that we might arrive at that when people think of drag that they first don't think of you? That sounds crazy, but you know what I mean? Because how much of a difference has it really made if so much of what the popular imagination around drag is focused around one person, around you?
Yeah, no, I get it. You know, I don't know how to answer that. My life as a human on this planet really isn't wrapped up in drag. It just so happens that I listened to the universe's stage direction and said, oh, okay, well, that's my path. Okay, let's do it. Let's go for it. I am here on this planet to have fun and to enjoy myself and to experience all the colors in the crayon box. If I never do drag, I'm cool. We cool.
Oh, we wouldn't be cool with that, though.
But just know that whatever I'm doing, I'm going to be enjoying myself and doing something creative and exploring my life. But the future of drag, you know, the thing is, everything changes. Thank God everything changes. I'm not afraid of change. I've made peace with change. In fact, you never know where that next big idea is coming from.
Yeah. So you can't give us any teasers at all about what's coming up next on Drag
Well,
Race?
I will tell you that we have filmed season 11 and All-Stars 4. We did that during the summer, and it is mind-blowing. We have a group of kids who on the show, unlike anything we've had before, and I've said this before, but it's true. We've got a bunch of kids who will blow you away, and they're so diverse and so different. And of course, these are kids who grew up watching Drag Race, so they think they know what's coming, but they do not.
I mean,
they do not.
Just in season 10, you were making a point that what Aquaria was like 10, right?
Yes.
When Drag Race got started.
Yes, yes. It's amazing.
And she walked away the winner of the last season. Well, RuPaul's new book is called Guru, and of course, RuPaul is the host and producer of the Emmy Award-winning RuPaul's Drag Race. RuPaul Charles, it's been a real pleasure and privilege to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Miriam Wasser. We've had help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.